Okay, so like imagine this, you and a couple of your law school buddies are driving back from like a late night study session,
Right,
right?
I've been there.
Yeah, and like it's late and you get pulled over for speeding, totally normal, happens all the time. But then the officer, while he's, checking the driver's license and stuff, he sees something suspicious. He finds drugs, right? Yeah, hidden in the back seat. And here's the kicker. It's within easy reach of everyone in the car. So the officer's like, "Whose are these?" And no one says a word. Can they just arrest all of you just because no one's, fessing up?
Well, that's a really interesting scenario, and it's one that that the Supreme Court actually had to grapple with. It
Yeah.
sounds a lot like a bar exam hypothetical,
No,
right?
totally does. And that's what we're gonna dive into today. This case, Maryland v. Pringle.
Pringle is such a fascinating case, especially for law students, because it really dives deep into the whole concept of probable cause during vehicle stops, especially when you've got multiple people in the car and some hidden contraband. When is it actually okay to arrest everyone? It's a huge question for Fourth Amendment law.
Right. And that's what we're going to try to figure out in our deep dive today. We're going to unpack the legal principles around probable cause in these shared vehicle situations, and we're going to look specifically at how Pringle shaped the law in this area.
Absolutely. And it's like, we're not just going to skim the surface here. We've actually got a ton of resources to really dig into this. Like, we've got some guidance specifically written for law students on how to approach these kinds of cases. We've got a really detailed case brief that breaks down all the important facts and arguments. And then we've got the, standard legal brief from the actual case.
Oh, and we even have a perplexity analysis, which like examines some of the complexities and potential uncertainties in the court's reasoning.
Yeah, so we're going to break down all of that and more to help you guys really understand the significance of Pringle.
Okay, so before we get too deep into the legal stuff, let's set the scene, right? Take us back to the night it all went down.
All right, so it's August 7, 1999. It's about 3:16 in the morning, and a Nissan Maxima is cruising down the road in Baltimore County when suddenly.
Whoa, hold on. You're telling me this all went down at 3:16 in the morning? Like, were these guys coming from a club or something?
Well, we don't know exactly where they were coming from, but yeah, 3:16 a.m. is definitely a detail worth noting. Maybe they were studying late, or maybe they were out having some fun.
All right, fair enough. So we've got our Nissan Maxima. It's 3:16 in the morning. What happens next?
Okay, so they're driving along and they get pulled over for speeding.
Okay, speeding makes sense. It is 3:16 in the morning.
Right, so the officer approaches the car, and behind the wheel is Dante Partlow, who's also the owner of the car. Joseph Germain Pringle is riding shotgun, and Otis Smith is in the back seat.
All right, so we've got our three main players: Partlow, Pringle, and Smith. Classic setup for a good legal drama.
Totally. So the officer's doing his routine thing, talking to the driver, checking his license, and that's when he notices a roll of cash, $763 to be exact, just sitting there in the glove compartment.
$763 in cash, just casually hanging out in the glove compartment. Definitely starts to raise some eyebrows, right? Like, is this normal?
Well, it's not necessarily illegal to have cash, but it's definitely a detail that a police officer might find suspicious, especially in the context of a traffic stop.
Right, especially at 3:06 in the morning. So what happens next? Does the officer just let them go with a warning?
Well, he gives Partlow a verbal warning for speeding, but then he asks a pretty crucial question: are there any weapons or illegal drugs in the car?
Okay, so now things are getting serious. What does the driver say?
Partlow says no, there are no weapons or drugs, and get this, he even agrees to let the officer search the car.
He agrees to a search. I mean, if he knew there were drugs in the car, why would he agree to that?
Well, we don't know for sure what was going through his mind at that moment. Maybe he thought they were well hidden, or maybe he was just trying to seem cooperative. But whatever the reason, he consents to the search.
Okay, so the officer's searching the car. What does he find?
Remember that backseat armrest we were talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Well, tucked behind it, the officer finds five baggies of cocaine.
Five baggies. That's more than just a little personal stash.
Right. It's a significant amount, which is going to play a role in the probable cause analysis later on.
Okay, so the officer finds the drugs. What happens to our three amigos now?
The officer asks the million-dollar question: okay, guys, who do the drugs belong to? And all three of them, Partlow, Pringle, and Smith, they all deny any knowledge or ownership.
They all clam up. I mean, wouldn't someone just confess and try to save the others?
Well, in the heat of the moment, it's hard to say how anyone would react. Maybe they were scared, maybe they had a pact, or maybe they all genuinely had no idea the drugs were there.
Okay, but the drugs were right there in the backseat. How could they not know?
Well, we'll get into that more later when we talk about constructive possession and the whole idea of a common enterprise. But for now, let's just stick with the facts.
All right, fair enough. So, all three guys deny the drugs. No one's talking. What does the officer do?
At that point, with no one claiming ownership and the drugs clearly present, the officer makes the decision to arrest all three of them.
He arrests all of them. That seems, I don't know, a little extreme. Like, can you really do that? Just arrest everyone just because they were in the same car?
That's exactly the question at the heart of this case. It's about whether there was probable cause to believe that each individual in that car was involved in the crime of possessing those drugs.
So they get hauled down to the police station. What happens next?
Okay, so this is where things get interesting from a procedural perspective. At the station, Pringle confesses. He says that the cocaine is actually his and that Partlow and Smith had nothing to do with it. Partlow and Smith maintain their innocence.
So Pringle takes the fall for everyone. What happens to him?
Well, he's charged under Maryland law with possession of cocaine and possession with intent to distribute, which is a more serious charge because of the quantity of drugs involved.
Okay, and what's his defense? He can't really deny the drugs were his at this point, can he?
Well, his defense focuses on the legality of his arrest. He argues that his Fourth Amendment rights were violated because the officer didn't have probable cause to arrest him specifically.
Okay, I can see where he's coming from. Like, yeah, he had the drugs, but does that mean the officer could just automatically assume he was involved just because he was in the car?
Right, that's the whole crux of the issue. So the case goes to trial, and Pringle tries to suppress his confession, arguing that it was the fruit of an illegal arrest.
So what did the trial court say?
The trial court denied his motion to suppress, meaning they allowed the confession to be used as evidence. Pringle was found guilty and sentenced to 10 years in prison.
10 years? That seems like a pretty hefty sentence.
It was a serious charge, and the trial court clearly felt there was enough evidence to convict him. But that wasn't the end of the story.
Okay, so the case goes to appeal, right?
Exactly. And the Maryland Court of Special Appeals actually upheld the conviction. They agreed with the trial court that there was enough evidence to support the arrest and conviction.
So, case closed.
Not quite. Here's where things take another turn. The case then goes to the highest court in Maryland, the Maryland Court of Appeals, and they reverse the decision.
They overturn the conviction. Wow, so they sided with Pringle on the probable cause issue.
Yeah, their reasoning was that there wasn't enough specific evidence connecting Pringle directly to the cocaine. They argued that the mere fact that he was a passenger in the car wasn't enough to establish probable cause.
Okay, I'm starting to see how this case ended up at the Supreme Court.
Exactly. The state of Maryland obviously disagreed with the Maryland Court of Appeals ruling. So they appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case.
They granted certiorari. And this is where things get really interesting, right? Because now we get to see how the highest court in the land interprets probable cause in these shared vehicle situations.
Absolutely. And this case really boils down to one key question. Did the arrest of Pringle, the front seat passenger, violate his Fourth and 14th Amendment rights because there wasn't enough probable cause to believe that he knowingly possessed the cocaine found in the back seat?
And how did the Supreme Court answer that question?
Well, in unanimous decision written by Chief Justice Rehnquist, the Supreme Court said that the arrest was constitutional. They found that there was, in fact, probable cause to arrest Pringle.
They all agreed. No dissenting opinions or anything.
Nope. All nine justices agreed that the officer's actions were justified.
Wow. Okay, so let's break down the court's reasoning here, because this is where it gets really important for us law students, right? How did they justify their decision?
Right, so the court really emphasized the concept of the totality of the circumstances. They said that when determining probable cause, you can't just look at one isolated piece of evidence. You have to consider all the facts together and look at the big picture.
Okay, so it's not about finding one smoking gun. It's about looking at everything together.
Exactly. And they specifically rejected the Maryland Court of Appeals approach of requiring this direct, specific link between Pringle and the drugs.
So what specific circumstances did they consider in this case?
Well, first, they pointed to the fact that they were in a car. They emphasized that cars are small, confined spaces, and illegal items found in a car are often accessible to everyone inside.
Okay, that makes sense. It's not like a house where you can have separate rooms and people might not know what's in other areas.
Right. And then they considered the quantity of cocaine. Five baggies suggested more than just personal use. It pointed towards drug dealing. And the court reasoned that someone involved in drug dealing is unlikely to have completely innocent passengers in their car.
Yeah, because those innocent passengers could potentially turn into witnesses, right?
Exactly. And then, of course, there was that roll of cash in the glove compartment. Again, not necessarily illegal on its own, but when you add it to the mix, it further supports the idea that something criminal might be going on.
So the court's looking at the car, the drugs, the cash, and they're saying, this looks pretty suspicious.
Right. And then there's another important legal concept that comes into play here. Constructive possession. Under Maryland law, constructive possession means having the ability to exercise control over something, even if you don't physically possess it at that moment.
Okay, so even if Pringle wasn't holding the drugs, he could still be considered in possession if he had the ability to access them.
Exactly. And because the cocaine was hidden in a spot that was accessible to all three occupants, the court found it reasonable for the officer to infer that they all had the ability to control it, either individually or jointly.
So they're all kind of lumped together because of their shared access to the drugs?
Right. And that ties into what the court called a common enterprise.
Yeah.
Chief Justice Rehnquist made the point that in the context of drug dealing, it's unlikely that those involved would bring along innocent bystanders who could later testify against them.
Okay, so the fact that all three of them denied ownership actually strengthens the suspicion that they were all in on it together.
Exactly. It's like, if they were all truly innocent, wouldn't at least one of them have spoken up and said, hey, those aren't mine, and I have no idea where they came from?
So the court's saying that given all these circumstances, it was reasonable for the officer to believe that a crime was being committed and that all three occupants were potentially involved.
Right. And it's really important to note that the court wasn't saying that the officer had to be absolutely certain that Pringle was guilty. Mm. They were just saying that there was enough probable cause to justify the arrest.
Right. Probable cause isn't about proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a lower standard.
Exactly. As Chief Justice Rehnquist said, in his opinion, the standard for probable cause is a practical, non-technical conception based on everyday life, not legal technicalities. It's about what a reasonable person would believe, given the facts at hand.
And the court found that, in this case, a reasonable person would have believed that Pringle was involved in the possession of those drugs.
Right, and they specifically emphasized that the officer didn't need to have direct evidence linking Pringle to the drugs. The totality of the circumstances was enough to establish probable cause.
Okay, so to be crystal clear, what was the Supreme Court's official holding in this case?
They held that Pringle's arrest was constitutional because, based on the totality of the circumstances, there was probable cause to believe that he had committed the crime of possessing cocaine, either alone or jointly with the other occupants of the vehicle.
So the presence of contraband in a shared vehicle, where all occupants have access and no one claims ownership, can be enough to create a reasonable inference of collective control and knowledge.
Exactly. And this holding has had a pretty significant impact on how law enforcement conducts vehicle stops and makes arrests.
How so?
Well, Pringle essentially allows officers to arrest all occupants of a vehicle if contraband is found and ownership isn't immediately clear. They don't have to figure out who the guilty party is right then and there.
Okay, so it gives officers more leeway in these situations.
Right, but it's important to remember that this doesn't mean that everyone in the car will automatically be convicted. Probable cause is just the first step.
Right. It just justifies the arrest and further investigation.
Exactly. It's then up to the prosecution to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a much higher standard.
So for us law students, what are the key takeaways from Pringle?
Well, I think one of the biggest takeaways is that probable cause is not about checklists or rigid rules. It's a fluid concept that's based on reasonable inferences drawn from the totality of the circumstances.
And that the specific facts of each case matter a lot.
Absolutely. In Pringle, the fact that the drugs were in a shared space, that no one claimed ownership, that there's a large amount of cash present, and that the arrest happened late at night, all of those factors contributed to the court's finding of probable cause.
It's also a good reminder of the difference between probable cause and proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes, that's crucial. And the court in Pringle was very clear that probable cause is a lower standard based on practical, non-technical considerations. It doesn't require absolute certainty.
So what can we take away from this in terms of how the courts balance the Fourth Amendment rights of individuals with the needs of law enforcement?
Well, Pringle shows us that the court is willing to give law enforcement some leeway when it comes to vehicle stocks, especially when there's evidence of potential criminal activity.
Hmm.
The sheer nature of a vehicle, the potential for danger, and the need for quick action all play into this.
Right, but that doesn't mean that individuals give up all their rights just because they're in a car.
Absolutely not. It's a delicate balance, and the court has to weigh the competing interests very carefully.
So, what are some of the potential implications of this common enterprise inference? Could this logic be extended to other shared spaces or situations beyond a vehicle?
That's a good question. Like, what about a dorm room? Or a shared apartment? Or even just a group of friends hanging out in a park? Where do we draw the line?
Right. If a group of people are together and something illegal is found, can the police just assume that everyone's involved simply because of their proximity to the contraband?
It's definitely something to think about.
Mm-hmm.
The Pringle ruling certainly opens the door for that kind of logic to be applied in other contexts.
So this is definitely something for you law students out there to keep in mind as you continue your studies. Probable cause is a complex area of law, and Pringle is just one piece of the puzzle.
Right. And it's a piece that continues to be debated and analyzed to this day.
It makes you wonder, you know, if you're ever in a situation like this, what would you do? Would you stay silent? Would you try to explain yourself? It's a tough call.
Yeah. It's one of those things you never really think about until you're actually faced with it. But it's important to know your rights and to understand how the law works.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. Big thanks to our expert for breaking down this fascinating case for us.
You got it. Always happy to dive into some good law.
And to all you future lawyers out there, keep studying hard. And remember, probable cause is a tricky beast. Always be thinking critically and asking those tough questions.
Absolutely. Until next time.
See